Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z.
That I missed, but then my homework was never quite.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast. My name is Mark Striegel, and right there, classic Van Halen off the 1984 record, Hot for Teacher, of course. And joining me, a Van Halen expert, he is the author of Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal, is author Greg Renoff. Greg.
Hey, Mark. I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, fourth time here. And I got to tell you, I get so many comments about your previous appearances on the show. People just really love hearing you talk about Van Halen.
I'm really happy to hear that. And it's fourth time. It's a nice honor to have come on four times. So hopefully I'm not going to wear out my welcome. But thanks. That's nice to hear.
Yeah, I actually just the producer, there's this new TV show on called Ozzy and Jack's World Detour, which I've been hyping on the show. We just had Jack Osborne on. And anyways, the producer of that show told me that he listened to the first podcast you did with me just recently. And then he had to listen to the next two. He thought they were good. So yeah, he's a big Van Halen fan. So having said that, we just heard Hot for Teacher, and that's off of the 1984 record. And you recently wrote an article for Ultimate Classic Rock. It's up online at ultimateclassicrock.com. And the article was titled How David Lee Roth Really Left Van Halen.
Mm-hmm.
Now your book, Van Halen Rising, which I highly recommend all the Talking Metal listeners pick up, deals specifically with the early era of Van Halen going up to the first, right after the first record, right?
Right.
Yeah. So this is a totally different time frame that we haven't spoken with you about, and that you wrote this brief article for Ultimate Classic Rock that I wanted to get into, because I find it an exciting time in Van Halen history, because for me personally, I'm 46 years old. I wasn't listening to the first Van Halen record in 1978 when it came out. However, by the time I was 12 to, 16, that time frame, I was like obsessed with these guys, and I specifically remember this whole era of David Lee Roth leaving the band and the emotions and the feelings that I had about the whole thing, which were big for a teenager who was kind of a music geek, and so one of the things you do in this classic Ultimate Classic Rock article is you basically talk about this date that has kind of become part of Van Halen lore, if you will, April 1st, 1985, the day that many people think David Lee Roth shocked the rock world by announcing he was leaving Van Halen to pursue a solo career. So let's talk about that date, April 1st, 1985.
That date, I don't know when or how that date got sort of invented on the internet. But what I did in researching the book, I was doing some reading, and I remember, again, my book Van Halen Rising doesn't actually cover this period, but it was this situation where I was doing some reading, and I would be reading April 1st, and like, he announced it on April Fool's Day. So that's sort of weird. I don't remember that, but that was what people were saying this. And then I wanted to write this article for Ultimate Classic Rock, and I ended up going back through Rolling Stone, and I started reading Rolling Stone magazine on microfilm in the library and scrolling through March, April, May, and I'm going, well, it must be in here. I'm going back and looking and looking. It's not in there. I don't really know where that sort of popped up, but it's actually not true that there was any announcement on April 1st. The announcement actually came in around July 85. Eddie tells Rolling Stone, and then the article, hits the newsstand, or hits the newsstands probably a little bit earlier, and that's it. Like late July is when the news actually came out. Now people around the band knew that things had gone bad, but in terms of the general public knowing that there was this fracture in Van Halen that was severe, and as I mentioned, the article that in July 4th issue of Rolling Stone, which probably again came out a few weeks earlier, said that their Van Halen was on permanent hold, they're scouting around for new lead singer. So there were definitely hints, but in terms of the sort of it's over, Eddie blasts Roth in the in that mid-August issue of Rolling Stone saying, quote, Dave left to be a movie star. You know, he even had the balls to ask if I'd write the score for his new movie for him. And he said, I'm moving on. And so that was the sort of the I think for most fans, that's how they found out. Like 98% of us who weren't in Los Angeles and didn't maybe know more, that was what was going on.
Right. Which back in those days, you know, there was no internet.
Right.
It's like nowadays, you know, Slash says something and his roadie tells somebody, and then the next thing you know, it's on the internet, and stuff just spreads so fast via internet and text messages and stuff like that. Back in those days, things could go months and years without word getting out.
Oh yeah. And getting back to the issue of how the April 1st date started, I remember, and you probably remember, people, oh, Dave's going to quit Van Halen. There was, you know, as a fan at the time, and as I've talked about, this was basically my first year of Van Halen fandom, 84 to 85. I remember being nervous because there were these hints that you were reading in magazines, like that thing in Rolling Stone, and there were some of the guitar magazines. There were these little, you know, Eddie Van Halen's been hanging out with Patti Smyth, wants her to sing. You know, so there were these sort of hints, but there was no finality to it until Eddie basically unloaded on Roth and Rolling Stone in that issue in August.
Right. So kind of to back up a little bit from this point, we're talking about, you know, July 1985. Let's go back to 1984. We just heard the song Hot for Teacher. That album, just such a great record. So many great songs. No cover songs on that record, which was, you know, rare for Van Halen, especially after Diver Down, which had five covers on it, I think, or six.
Sounds right.
Yeah. So they were back with an album of all original material. Now, a couple of those songs on that record were older songs, right? House of
Correct.
Pain, and is it Girl Gone Bad? Or,
well, Girl Gone Bad at least dated back a year earlier. I'm trying to think if there was another song on there. I don't think if there was any other songs. Jump dated back at least a couple of years. I mean,
really? Wow.
That the from what I understand, in 1981 or 82, Eddie had this demo of Jump, which was basically just a riff. You know, basically the riff wasn't really a song, but it was the idea for Jump on a cassette, and had played it for Ted Templeman and Roth and some of the other guys in the band, but even his brother apparently, who were not particularly enthused about him taking up the keyboards as a full-time instrument. And so, but House of Pain is the song that would be the oldest of the bunch there.
Cool. And the song we just heard coming into the show, Hot for Teacher, where did that song come from? Because it almost sounds like it started out of a jam session or something, the way it starts with the drums and then the tapping on the guitar. It almost seems like it's like a freeform jam there at the beginning. Is that where it started from? Do you have any history behind that specifically?
Yeah. So if you listen to the brother, some of the bootlegs that are around from the early club days, they were definitely familiar with what you call boogie rock. So ZZ Top, and there was another group called Cactus who they really, really liked. And there was a band, a song called Parchment Farm, which sort of became the blueprint for I'm the One. This song in particular is interesting. I think if you listen to a album called Spectrum by Billy Cobham, there's a song on that album called Quadrant Four, which is actually it's a fusion album, jazz fusion, and Tommy Bolin plays guitar on it. And if you listen to it, the drum pattern is very, very similar. So I sort of imagine that the brothers, who did like fusion, jazz fusion, and sort of their, what do I call it, like kind of their geekiness in terms of their interest in pushing the envelope, maybe outside what they would do in Van Halen, they were listening to Jeff Beck's Wired and some of this other fusion at the time. I don't doubt that they heard that song, because if you listen to it, it's pretty clear the pattern, the sort of that boogie, that shuffle pattern on the drums. And then it became this, from what I know from talking to Ted Templeman, the song itself became very much this project for Roth and the studio and the rest of the band. Right. They had the pattern, but they also were working on the breakdown parts, and that they brought tables, kids tables, Roth brought kid tables and chairs, and set up bottles and cans, and set up basically like a little school room. They simulated a little school bell.
Wow.
To get them into the part. And so Templeman, when I talked to him about this, talked about how how that really showed Ross' creativity, that he was willing to go the extra mile to be like, it's not just enough for us to sit here around a microphone and pretend we're going to be in the schoolroom. We're going to set up these little – they had little school desks right. in 5150. So, you know, for me, that is something that is run through the thread of all the Van Halen records, that what you kind of call the power shuffle. You know, I'm the One, The Full Bug,
yeah.
Hot for Teacher. These are the songs that for me was always a big, you know, bottoms up, a big part of the Van Halen sound. And this one is, I think, arguably the most well-developed of those shuffles. I mean, it really, really is just so locked in and so powerful. And yeah, that song, again, has that, I think, that older genesis of that idea, but they really took it and did something. And of course, Roth made it a very commercial, a commercial thing with the lyrics and everything. I think if Roth had, you know, I can imagine another lyricist coming up with a chorus and an idea for the song that wouldn't have been halfway as engaging to teenagers. That, as we all know, that was like, you know, as a teenager, you immediately snicker because you understand.
Yeah.
As a boy, as a 16-year-old boy, that there are some teachers who are pretty hot, and you're like, wow, this is pretty cool. I'm in this classroom with this very hot young woman. Yeah. So Roth kind of, you know, he knew how to connect lyrically. And I think,
yeah, you said young woman. I will throw this out there that now the in the music video, the model that played the hot teacher, just gorgeous woman, obviously. But I believe she was well into her 30s when she starred in the music video, which is kind of funny. Interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned this song. Let's go back. Tommy Boland. It was I know he did a fusion record, I think, in between when he had been in James Gang and Deep Purple. Tommy Boland, of course, the great young guitar player from Iowa, who somehow ended up in this British band, legendary band Deep Purple, replacing Blackmore, and put out one great record called "Come Taste the Band" by Deep Purple. Blackmore-less Deep Purple record, which is just fantastic record. But was never really accepted by the fan base, or never did well commercially. But anyways, that aside, this Tommy Boland song. Tell us again the record and the name of the song that you believe influenced Hot for Teacher.
Yeah, if you go, it's on YouTube. The album came out in 1973. It's was by a jazz drummer named Billy Cobham, who I believe had played with Miles Davis, if I'm remembering correctly. Someone will correct me inevitably in the comments if I'm wrong. And then he brought in Tommy Boland to play on this one track, you'll hear it. And actually, I have no doubt that the Deep Purple guys heard this stuff and was like, wow, this guy is amazing. It's an incredible solo, and it has that shuffle boogie groove with the long drum introduction. And interestingly enough, it has a keyboard part by Jan Hammer that sounds quite a bit like the tapping Eddie would have done in the introduction. So,
wow,
you know, it's just sort of a seed of an idea that they probably pulled out, and they definitely made it their own in how they pulled it off on Van Halen. You'll hear the difference, but I think the influence is there.
Cool. So 1984, the album comes out, and it's pretty much an immediate smash hit, right? I mean, Jump, I think, came, the single for Jump was out before the album dropped, I believe. Is that,
I think, a week before, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, and the video for that, very simple. They go on a massive world tour. I'm guessing mostly sold out shows for that tour. And then when do things start kind of falling apart? Is it on tour? Is it when Roth decides he's going to go off and do this EP, Crazy from the Heat EP? When do we feel things start to unravel? I mean, there were always, you know, issues. You know, there was always tension, it seems like, between Roth and Eddie, but it seems like they really hit a breaking point somewhere around, what, 1984, possibly 1985?
You know, I'd even go back. I mean, probably like Roth would say that he always expected the call to come in at any time to his hotel room that, you know, that the band has left and you're fired. You know, they've all moved on to the next city to play the show without you. So I think Roth always had this sense that he was in a uncomfortable position in some ways with the brothers. But, you know, I think what we can look back on is the aftermath of Diver Down. From what I understand, the time, and if you listen to interviews that Eddie did or read them from 1982, Eddie seemed to be fairly enthused about Diver Down when it came out, about even Dancing in the Street, which he has famously trashed, saying that he really didn't like it and he wished that they had not, the song had not come out that way. The album itself, at some point, it must have started to stick in his craw about the way that maybe the cover songs were used, or that maybe some of his musical pieces were used to perform cover songs. And so he builds his own studio. And I think right there is where you start to see issues start to develop. For instance, one thing that ends up happening, and this has been covered in articles in the press and a couple of books have talked about this as well, is that there's this sort of tension that begins to develop around Ted Templeman and Eddie Van Halen. Eddie draws closer to his engineer, Don Landy. And in fact, Don is, I think, in effect, making some decisions about production that in the past that Ted would have done. But because Eddie's at his house, the studio is in his backyard, Don and Eddie are staying in the studio all night long. Ted will show up and things are being done. And so there's this difficult working situation. I think that
during,
all kind of –
during 1984?
Correct.
This
would be the making of 1980. So the aftermath of Diver Down, a part of this is Eddie builds his own studio. And I think there starts to be this difficulty that develops. And part of that, too, it seems to be around Roth as well. And again, that's stuff that those guys maybe have not made clear enough about what exactly went on. But there clearly was – some sort of issues developing, whether Roth's early rejections of Jump seemed to irk Eddie in some way.
Right.
I think in the end we can all agree that Jump turned out tremendously well and it was a brilliant single. But you know, then on tour, you know, I, if you listen to the bootlegs, I saw this tour. I didn't really think about it, of course, at the time. I had no idea about this, but it just became this very, very segmented performance where you had a 15-minute guitar solo from Eddie. You had these long raps from Roth where he would literally stand up and talk and do stand-up, in effect, for 12 right. minutes.
Yeah.
You know, Michael did a bass solo. There was a drum solo. There really wasn't it didn't feel like it was a very cohesive thing. At some point during the 1984 tour, Roth and Templeman decide – Roth approaches Templeman and says he wants to do this solo record, and that the wheels start going in motion with that. Templeman, when I've talked to him about this, has gone to great lengths to indicate that this was never meant to be anything but a fun outlet for Dave. And in part, from Templeman's perspective, he thought because things had gotten kind of tense and that things were seemed to be a little bit fragile, this right. might give everyone some time to blow off some steam. You know, do what you want for 6 months, just sort of a breathing room. You know, Templeman also has said to me that, you know, we were bringing in Christopher Cross. We were bringing in Carl from the Beach Boys. There was never, any indication on Templeman's perspective this was supposed to compete with Van Halen. And if anything, it was meant to be sort of a fun diversion and something that would be give the band some, as I said, I'm repeating myself, but give the band some breathing room. It clearly became something bigger as the singles took off and things like that. Things started to, unravel. So,
do you think there was a decision like at the record company level, like, wow, we got to push this EP? Because I mean, the EP and the music videos, they just blew up. I mean, they were all over the place. And
I'm going to guess that was from what I've been able to kind of put together. That was something of a surprise. I mean, I don't think that people thought, oh, it's going to flop, but I don't think anyone thought it was going to be a smash hit. And I think I think people at Warner Brothers, honestly, probably underestimated Roth. And I think that's probably one of the things that Roth has been faced his whole life is this underestimation of him, that he's sort of seen as this guy who's sort of this, you know, guy who's a good front man. But when it comes down to really doing songs and doing these other things, Eddie was sort of seen as the genius and Roth was sort of seen the guy who threw the lyrics together. And I think for the way that Roth ended up packaging it with the videos and the way he pulled off the performances in California Girls that came off so well, I think that probably was, I'm sure in the boardrooms of Warner Brothers, they were pleasantly surprised. I don't think they were going, oh, this is going to be a platinum big, big seller. So I don't think that was ever the idea.
It was an interesting record. Sid McGuinness, known for his time with the David Letterman band, did a lot of the guitars on that record, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Carl Wilson, Christopher Cross doing some backing vocals. Carl Wilson, I don't think he wrote California Girls. I think that was written by Brian Wilson, right, and Mike Love. But yeah, the Beach Boy vocalist, Carl Wilson. Interesting.
And there's something else I wanted to.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry, I wanted to throw in one other thing too that was going on at this time as well. So the album comes out, I believe, in January of '85, Roth's EP. So the EP was being worked on in the months prior to that. At some point around that time, if you read Roth's book, he talks about how he showed up. I think he says, Ted and I came up to 5150. We were supposed to start working on the new record. We knocked on the door. No one came to the door. Eddie didn't come to the door. He basically wouldn't come out of the studio. And so there was this sort of weird dysfunction going on, right? That this thing that also happened where Roth talked about, I took some of the songs with me to New Guinea. Roth went to New Guinea in September 1984, or I guess maybe October 1984, on one of his Jungle Studs adventures. And he talks about how he, lost the tape while he was traveling or something like that. So it was all this sort of passive aggressive stuff going on that was just, I think, emblematic of this deeper issue. And the other thing that I learned post writing this classic rock piece, this classic rock magazine piece, I had a chance to talk to Pete Angelus, who was later managed Roth, but also worked closely with Van Halen since 1977. He had been part of their lighting crew, or their lighting guy, excuse me, and then was their creative consultant, basically the guy who was working with the album covers, coming up with the stage concepts, working with Roth on all of these things. And he talked to me about how when the movie idea was first considered, Angelus and Roth pitched it to the Van Halen band. So instead of it being Dave's going to make a movie, it was, right, hey guys, let's do something like The Kids Are All Right, like The Who did, or Hard Day's Night, okay, or something like that. It was going to be a Van Halen movie. And so Angelus had, according to what Angelus told me, he had worked up a script that basically had these guys in it. And, I don't know what exactly it would have been like, but I imagine there would have been sort of like the music video type skits with some live performances, that type of stuff. And Angelus had this idea for this movie, and Roth did too. And the rest of the band passed. So, I mean, that's another part of this story here, is that while I don't want to be solely defending Roth here, because I think there's clearly Roth had ambitions, there was an opportunity to sort of pitch this to the band to say, hey, how about this? And that was said, they said no to that. And so, right, there was this, it seems like the pieces were coming apart, and there was no way to sort of put them back together very easily in the post 1984 tour.
So do you believe that there was an actual script written for this movie that included, Eddie, Alex, and Michael in the movie? Or do you think it was more of just a pitch idea? Hey, let's do this movie. Or do you think,
I can't speak to that, but what I gathered from Angelus, that he had worked up this idea and was into it, that he was, they were serious about doing this movie. It wasn't just sort of, they had come up with the idea 2 days before and just called a band meeting, that they had started working up the idea. And so I don't know, how far along he was on it, but clearly he had, and Roth had, a vision for what they wanted to do with it. And
okay, now the guy, the other Angelus, is that his name?
Pete Angelus, right? Okay. Pete Angelus, who,
you know, if you look, one of the fabulous Picasso brother guys?
Absolutely, yeah. He's the other guy in the video. So he was, he was Roth's co-conspirator. He was the guy. They were close at that time, and they bounced ideas off each other, and he ended up managing Roth's solo career. So,
and he was also in some music videos too. Was he in Yankee Rose?
He was in the beginning of the, I believe in the beginning of the Yankee Rose. Yes, he was in the Yankee Rose video. He was in all of the videos. And then he went on to manage the Black Crowes.
Oh, wow. So, okay. So what was his history? Like, how did he become in with Roth? How did he get in with Roth?
Yeah. So Pete's a very, very funny guy. Pete told me a story where he met those guys basically on the Sunset Strip in 1977, because he was working at the Whiskey, and he had a poor initial interaction. I'll keep the story short, but he had a poor initial interaction with those guys. And eventually he and Dave sat down at the bar and had a beer together. they started talking, and Angelus had been in film school, and Angelus had some ideas for the light show for this is in the club, end of the club days for Van Halen. And he became one of their most trusted employees, and he survived. I mean, people come and go in these tours, tour managers, these types of things. But he was there from 77 through the breakup, and then was with Roth until probably 91 or so.
What capacity was he a tour manager?
He was the head of lighting at first, head and then became then the creative consultant and lighting director. So if you read the back of the liner notes of the albums, it'll say Pete Angelus, creative consultant. So working on the artwork for the albums, thinking about what are the stages going to look like? What's the lights going to look like? How are we going to put the show together? And then he eventually, after Van Halen breaks up, he becomes Roth's manager. He manages David Lee Roth.
Right. So Crazy from the Heat is out, and is it safe to say that Eddie did not like the fact that this album, this EP, became so popular? Do we know that?
There's an interview that I would urge everyone to take a minute and look up on YouTube and watch. It's about a 10-minute interview with Martha Quinn. It was done in January or February of 1985 at the Hard Rock in New York. So if you Google Hard Rock Van Halen 1985, it's Eddie and Valerie sitting together. And it's this very awkward interview where Eddie's nervously drinking his beer. Martha Quinn is asking perfectly appropriate questions like, so when's the new album going to come out? Who's producing it? Eddie announces kind of offhandedly, oh, Ted's not going to do the record. Don Landy and I, Don Landy being the engineer who had worked closely with Eddie in 1984 and had been on the Van Halen record since the beginning, we're going to produce it. And there's this interesting moment where, he says something like, oh, I've got enough material for two solo records. And you can see Valerie sort of encouraging him to keep talking about that. Right. And you could sort of see the pitch of the interview is what's going on with Van Halen. And there's just all of this fuzziness, and you can sort of see the conversation, the way Eddie's responding as he has this sort of lack of confidence in Van Halen. Valerie seems to be encouraging the fact that, hey, you know what, you could make a solo record, which I have no doubt he could have. Could have made one at the time. And so there's this, you can sort of see the wheels are coming off, and it's very awkward, very awkward. And it's really very, very telling. He's got the short hair. He's just cut his hair short, and he's in this varsity jacket with an MTV logo on it, one of those like a high school or college red, leather sleeve jackets. It's very interesting to see this.
So is there one day that we know of? It's obviously not April 1st. We've said that it's more like July. But is there one day prior to the kind of word getting out in July where things come to a head and it's over? This is it. Or does it kind of just peter out?
By June, if I'm remembering correctly, Roth has enlisted Billy Sheehan for his new group. And so some point in there in around May or June, early June, there's this meeting at Roth's house that Roth talks about in his book and Eddie's talked about, where they get together and it's just sort of hash out what the hell's going on. And they basically decide, according to Roth, to go their separate ways. Roth talks about how we hugged, we cried together.
Right.
We wished each other the best and we walked away. And the interesting thing is that if you read Roth's book, he seems to imply that he thought it was going to be amicable, or at least publicly it was going to be amicable. It was one of these things where no one was going to go down and basically throw punches or anything like that. It was going to be, we're going in a different direction, whatever it was going to be. Or, this is just sort of my reading between the lines, maybe in Roth's mind he thinks, I do my solo record and then we get back together, sort of like the way the Stones used to do in the 80s. Like, they didn't officially, quote unquote, break up, but there's sort of this mix doing a solo record. There's nothing going on with the Stones, and everyone sort of just is a little bit grumpy at each other, but no one, Mick doesn't come out and rip Keith, and Keith doesn't rip Mick. But, soon after that, Roth went full on ahead with this new band and everything. And so, in terms of what he's doing with his career as well, he has kind of gone all in now on the idea of having his own band and trying to make this movie, the aborted Crazy from the Heat, which never ends up getting made. But this is the idea, is to make a movie with starring David Lee Roth.
So, so, And what happens with the movie? Why does it never get made? You think a guy as famous as Roth was at that point could have gotten the movie made.
What ended up happening with the movie is Roth and Angelus had a movie deal, full-blown movie deal with CBS Theatrical Pictures. CBS Theatrical Pictures had had a couple of unsuccessful years. They were also involved in – CBS was also involved in litigation and trying to fight off a hostile takeover from Ted Turner.
Right.
And so what ended up happening is, if I'm remembering correctly, my memory might be a little bit off, in the fall, November, something like that, Angelus gets a call and it's from their attorney, and Roth's in the room and they're talking to the attorney, and the attorney tells them, I just got a call from CBS. They've pulled the plug. The movie deal is gone. And so CBS Theatrical Films just closed up shop. So it wasn't as if they dropped Roth. Let's say there were seven or eight movies in development. They closed down the whole thing. And so that's how they were left without a movie deal. But they were ready to start shooting the movie. They had the script. They had the costumes. In fact, Billy Sheehan has told me that the costumes, all of the costumes that were in all of the videos, Yankee Rose, California Girls, all of that stuff was going to be used for the movie. The characters, even a lot of the characters that sort of appear briefly in some of the videos, the California Girls video or Just a Gigolo video, some of these weird characters that were cartoon character type people, they were going to be sort of in the scenes in the movie, maybe not have speaking parts, but they were going to be in the movie. And so they were all ready to go, and then the plug got pulled. And then once that happened, Roth decided to go full on with doing a record. The twist to that is the idea was that they were going to make a movie, and when the movie came out, it was going to be like Purple Rain was. There's going to be a Purple Rain movie, and there's going to be the Purple Rain soundtrack. So it's supposed to be a movie, Crazy from the Heat, and there was going to be a soundtrack to go along with it. But once the movie fell off, right, they had written some songs that were going to appear in the movie. For example, Shy Boy was going to be in the movie. That's Life was going to be in the movie. Some of the other songs were going to be in the movie. They just went ahead with the idea of just doing a rock record, doing the tour, rather than worrying about trying to roll out the movie. But it was Angelus, when I interviewed him, he said it was a crushing blow to those guys, meaning that they were like ready to go. It was like, we're going to start this week, or they were starting in like just days from starting the shoot. And so to have that end like that was very disappointing. They litigated, which took a lot of time too. They had to do depositions, give evidence to try to recoup the money. And I'm not sure how all the money came out, but there was definitely a lawsuit. They sued basically CBS. And then by that point, I'm forgetting exactly when 5150 came out, but 5150 was out before Eat 'Em and Smile was out.
Yeah, right? Early 86.
And so that may have also maybe in Roth's head, the clock might have really been ticking. Like, we can't start up the movie. I got to get my career back going. And the best way to do that is to do the record with the band and Ted Templeman.
Right. And okay, so to jump ahead a little bit then, not that much. Let's see, March 1986, 5150 is released. And we've heard many times through, but you know, in interviews and stuff, how the Sammy came into the fold. I will just say personally, as a kid, I remember getting that record and being quite disappointed. You know, there was a few harder rock numbers, but there was also very heavy on the keyboards. And the thing that disappointed me most about the record, because I had been a Hagar fan, I had seen Hagar on the VOA tour, one of my first concerts, probably mm-hmm. my third concert or something, and loved Hagar. So I thought when the news came out that, okay, Hagar is going to be in teaming up with Eddie Van Halen, I thought it was just going to be fantastic. And maybe I was in the minority because I know the album did sell well, but it wasn't the hard driving rock sound and heavy metal sound for the most part. There was a couple songs out mm-hmm. there, but you know, that Van Halen had with those first six records. And I was disappointed. I was also disappointed in Eddie's guitar sound changed mm-hmm. on the record. So it wasn't even the more commercial songs, the keyboards. His guitar tone and sound was no longer quite as big as it used to be. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the whole production on the record, for me, I don't think it's aged super well. And again, you know, I had 5150. I wore out the tape. I saw the tour twice in New Jersey. I saw two shows. And so, you know, I'm trying to do some revisionist history or I'm trying to bash the record. It's just, to me, yeah, it's sort of the, you know, Eddie has a more affected guitar sound. The whole album has more of a soft feel to it. And I'm not super crazy about the drum sound. You know, I think part of that may have been just the Eddie indulging things he had maybe wanted to do that maybe in the past with Templeman and Roth in the room, maybe wouldn't have been accepted with open arms. I know from talking to Templeman, he was not super enthused at first with Jump, and he never really loved I'll Wait. But after Jump got worked up, he thought, wow, this is really, you know, he thought it was amazing, especially with the lyrics that Roth came up with and the way the whole song came together. He thought that it had really come together well. But, you know, there was this hesitancy among guys in the band, including Eddie's brother, from what I understand early on, to sort of be like, we don't want to become that keyboard focused band. And those guys, and they seem to have found a way, though, with 5150 to sort of walk that line where people still saw Eddie as a guitar hero. But yet it seems to me the keyboards, if anything, just sort of.
Yeah, I mean,
broadened out Eddie's genius to a lot of people.
You know, the bands I was into at that time were, you know, Maiden, Metallica. Sure. I liked the thrash stuff, but I also liked the more glammy stuff, the Motley Crue, even liked a little Poison. They were coming out right around that time. I was into all that, you know, and then I still loved the 70s era hard rock stuff was still just getting played over and over again on FM radio, the
right.
Zeppelins, the Bad Company, all that great stuff. So for me, there 5150 lost that edge that Van Halen had, that hard edge. So when Eat 'Em and Smile arrived 3-4 months after 5150, it was like, this is Van Halen. It was like, to me, Eat 'Em and Smile sounded more like the first 6 Van Halen records,
right,
than 5150 did. And, you know, there was more to it too. You know, there was the singles getting played on the radio, on commercial pop radio from 5150. The fact that they came out in their new look, it no longer looked rock or metal to me. They had cut the hair, the mullets, you know. And then Roth arrives with this record, which is to this day one of my favorite records, and it was just, I was at that moment after Eat 'Em and Smile hit, I liked Van Halen, and I still appreciated what they were doing with Sammy, and I bought the albums and I went and saw them in concert. But to me, I was definitely on Team Roth, because he, after delivering this EP, you know, Crazy from the Heat, which was more cover songs and mellower, I guess a lot of us were afraid, well, what's his solo record going to be like? And he gave a 1-2 punch right in your face. And again, the album sounded more Van Halen than 5150 did to me. And it wasn't just Roth. He had Templeman with him on the record. You know, he had that same kind of production sound that they had on those first 6 Van Halen records. Do we know what Roth thought of 5150, and was there a conscious effort, like, hey, we're gonna keep our hair, you know, long, we're gonna keep wearing the cool rock clothes, and,
right,
and we're gonna, you know, have this raw rock and roll sound on the album, because Van Halen doesn't have that anymore. Was he conscious of where Van Halen went with 5150?
You know, that's interesting. That's like one of the things I would love to ask David Lee Roth. I'm sure he heard some of the material that was on 5150. I'm sure he heard a good chunk of it. And that's the interesting thing, is like, what did he hear? I know that Roth had a tape that he supposedly lost, but you can be sure that he was familiar at least what the musical ideas were to some extent. Right. Templeman,
well,
too,
heard him on the radio at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know how, when he finished recording Eat 'Em and Smile, but you
know,
the 5150 was 4 months, I think, 3 to 4 months before, you know, Eat 'Em and Smile was released.
Yeah, the album was probably largely done at that point. But I think Roth certainly had decided that he was going to do much more of an aggressive album. There's that diversity is there. You still have, you know, I'm Easy and a couple of other songs. That's Life, which seemed to be a tip of the hat to the EP stuff,
right,
and really
sure
fit with Ross, schmaltzy, vaudevillian side of him, and really I think actually comes off well on the record for him. But you know, the elephant gun, going crazy, shy boy, Yankee Rose. I mean, that I think you're on target with that stuff. Seemed to me to be more in the spirit of the early Van Halen records.
Right.
But it's worth remarking as well, in terms of the tour sales, the 5150 tour. So they sold a lot more tickets than Roth did. Right. They did three nights in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Huge arena, 18,000 people. They were doing multiple. The Van Halen brand, for what it's worth, definitely paid dividends. I think the brothers having the name and having the band and just sort of having them, that whole the aftermath of 1984 with Van Halen becoming the biggest band in the world. You take Roth out of it, Roth has the name value as well, but it's nowhere near as important. And the Roth tour did well, but didn't sell tickets anywhere near like the.
Right. Well, I remember he did one night in Chicago where I saw him, and it had to be sold out, I'm pretty sure. I mean, if it wasn't, it was just about sold out. But then again, Chicago is a major market, so, who knows what he did in, Cincinnati or some, Kansas City or somewhere a little smaller. I don't know. But, yeah, the album definitely, to me, rocked hard. Big Trouble was on that, with great song, Bump and Grind. Elephant Gun, like you said. I don't know. I thought it was such a better record. Do you know when they came out with OU812? Was that a reference to the Eat 'Em and Smile title on Roth's album?
The story I've read about that is that Alex was riding on the highway and looked over at a truck, and the truck had some close. The numbers on the side of the truck were something close to OU812, or that maybe it was OU812, and he laughed hysterically and remembered. So I don't know, but I mean that wouldn't surprise me if they picked up on the double meaning there. And again, that story by Alex, I mean, I've read that in one interview. I mean, he may have made that up for the interview, but that's the story he tells, that's where that came from. That album produced by Don Landy, if I remember correctly, and Van Halen, right? That was the That was the one that they did without Mick Jones, and Don Landy's last appearance on a Van Halen record.
Right. And then Ted Templeton comes back into the Van Halen world, right? What album was that? The next record?
All right. That was the FUCK record. So what had happened is that there was this Roth and Templeton basically go off and do the Eat 'Em and Smile project. In the years that followed, Eddie and Ted worked together on a couple of records by a band called Private Life, which was a Warner Brothers band, I kind of equate them sort of like a Honeymoon Suite type of band, a little bit more poppy, but a hard rock sound. The album didn't sell particularly well, but those albums were recorded at 5150. And so Ted and Eddie worked on those records together. And then what ends up happening in 1990 or 1991, when they're working on the what's going to be called the Fuck record, that, as Sammy notes in his book, that he became frustrated with Andy Johns, did not want to work with Andy Johns any longer, and demanded that Templeton be brought in to produce his vocals, and that's what ended up happening.
And Ted had worked with Sammy, back in the Montrose days?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So that's where that worked out, is that Ted came in, it seems, because Andy and Sammy did not get along at all. And so this was a way of sort of going, okay, we'll work on the vocals, you guys do the rest, and we'll sort of come together and get it all done. But that was how that all ended up happening, that Ted was brought back in for that record.
Wow, interesting stuff. And circling back to the Eat 'Em and Smile band, we know Dave knew Billy Sheehan for a while because he had the Van Halen had Talas, Billy's band, out of Buffalo, New York, open for them. And, Billy was one of a kind bass player. So everyone took notice. And we now know that there were even times where they thought about bringing Billy into Van Halen. That's something Billy has said. This is before Dave left, of course. So it makes perfect sense that Dave would get Billy in his band. But what about Steve Vai? Where did Dave and Steve first meet? Do you have any info on that?
I do. So the first guy that Roth called was Sheehan. And so he recruits Sheehan, and then the person that he has his eye on is actually Steve Stevens. Now, Steve Stevens ends up doing the Atomic Playboys record for Warner Brothers. So yeah. What had already happened is there already been an overture between Warner Brothers Records and Steve Stevens to do a solo record. And so there was already these connections there. So
was
Roth,
Steve out of Billy Idol's band?
He was not. But he had made a deal basically to do the I think it's the Whiplash Smile record. Is that right? That may not be right. The album they were doing, 1985 with Billy Idol, that album was going to be finished. And then he wanted to do a solo record.
Whiplash Smile would have been later. So
I okay.
Don't know
what that, which yeah, one but... is the? It was the one that followed up Rebel Yell. The conversation happens in New York. Steve Stevens says, "Look, the timeline you want is basically you want me to come work for you right now." Meaning Roth, I want you know, wants Steve Stevens to go start writing songs right now. He's like, "I can't do it." And so the next guy who I guess gets seriously considered is Steve Vai. Templeman told me that he and Dave sat and listened to a cassette of Steve Vai's Flexible record. I think it was the Flexible record in a garage somewhere in Los Angeles. So sort of like, you know, in a car park, they were sitting there with this boombox listening because Dave had come to see Ted and they're talking. And he's like, yeah, this is the guy. I mean, he's great. You should go get him. And so then he calls Steve Vai. Steve Vai is finishing up his stint in Alcatraz. And then he joins up with Sheehan. And then Sheehan, Vai, and Vi's drummer, who's unfortunately his name is escaping me. I apologize for not being able to remember it. Are working in Roth's basement for some period of time. In the fall, Roth decides for whatever reason that he wants a different drummer. I can't remember Vi's drummer's name off the top of my head. By all accounts, this guy was an amazing drummer. It just was for whatever reason Dave wanted to go a different direction. They end up getting Bissonette, and then you have the band together by the fall of '85.
Right. And by the way, I was wrong about that. You were right. Whiplash Smile was 86. I was thinking of
Charm. Oh, it was one. Okay. I was right. They're not very memorable records in my opinion. So
yeah, Whiplash Smile had I think one hit, To Be a Lover, according to Wikipedia. But so Vi's drummer was being considered. Was that the same guy who played on Flexible with him? Because that would have been Zach.
I believe song. That's right. That's right. I'm trying to see if I can come up
with it. Is it Chad Wackerman? I would have to look up
the name. That's not his name. And of course, I'm killing myself. I can't remember his name here. But he, he's a great drummer. And that's sort of, what I talked to those guys about it, interviewing them for an article I did for Guitar World magazine. They were sort of, all of them, they were included in apparently what Ross just thinking was. It was just, Dave wants to go a different direction. It's Dave's band. Dave can do whatever he wants, basically. And that's how it ended up happening. And they ended up recruiting Bissonette.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to figure out who that drummer was. Chris, no. Sex and Religion.
Yes, so, that's right.
Chad Wackerman.
Chris.
Chris Frazier.
Chris Frazier, I believe, is the person. Yes. Okay. Yes.
There you go. Interesting. So I guess, because Vi had been playing with Alcatraz before that, but I believe he leaves Alcatraz to join David Lee Roth. So, yeah, interesting history. Yeah, it's always great talking to Van Halen. And, I got to ask you, I don't know if you can reveal if this is even happening, but any plans on writing another book? Because your book is so good. Again, it's Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal, and it goes really early on and kind of traces even the Van Halen brothers and Roth's childhood too, up into the first record or there shortly after. Were you considering doing another book that picks up where this one left off?
Well, let me be a little bit coy here because I don't have it put together fully enough to say what exactly I'm going to do, but it's going to be a Van Halen related book. I'll say that it's going to have, it'll, if you're a Van Halen fan, I think it'll be of interest. So,
okay, cool.
Keep my powder dry for now, but yeah, I appreciate the kind words and, it's been, fun to talk to you tonight. I can talk about this stuff all night.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We're at 50 minutes here, so we will wrap it up shortly, but, just a final note kind of to jump into, current times here. It's kind of been quiet on the Van Halen front. It appears that possibly that, you know, show that they did with Roth at the Hollywood Bowl a while back may have been the final show with Roth, but nothing else has really been announced at this point. And any guesses to where things go? I mean, there was this thing with David Lee Roth where he was going to possibly reunite with the Eat 'Em and Smile band, but the fire marshal closed down the club, so it never happened. And I kept thinking, well, they'll maybe do a tour or something, that lineup, but that never happened. And that makes me wonder, is Dave just kind of waiting to see what happens with Van Halen? Like, what's going on? Any insight?
Well, I think we can be pretty confident they're not recording new material. From what I understand, Wolfgang's still camped out at 5150 finishing his record, which I'm looking forward to hearing. Yeah. You know, he's played drums on it, he's playing guitar, he's playing bass, and so it's going to be really cool to hear that when that's done. But from what I understand, that's still ongoing. And so I don't think we're going to see a new Van Halen record soon. Reading between the lines, my speculation, I suspect that's what's going on, is that it's Roth is in a holding pattern waiting for them to make the next move. He's been, I think, trying to demonstrate to everyone who will pay any attention that I want to make music, I want to sing in the studio, I want to perform, I want to entertain. He's puts out these Roth Show episodes, which are eclectic to say the least, but right. Almost always have some song he's covered or something, you know, covered a Van Morrison song a few weeks ago. He's put together this material, and he's doing it in Henson Studios out in Hollywood. So, you know, I don't think he's working there for free. And so he's spending his own money doing this. And I think it's, you know, it's almost like him saying, it's like, I'm ready, you know, I'm in the studio, I'm ready to make new music, I want to do this. And for the others, you know, I can't speak to what exactly is going on. However, other than to say, it doesn't seem to me like anything's happening in the world of Van Halen in terms of a band album or tour. I don't think anything's in the works, but who knows? I mean, tomorrow we could find out Hagar's back in the band, right? I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, it seems as though Roth, he even mentioned after that thing was canceled at the, I forget the name of the club in LA where they were going to try to do this Eat 'Em and Smile reunion. I should know the name of that club. I forgot though. But anyways, he mentioned something. Oh, well, maybe we should do this down.
Yes.
At, what did he say? The Palladium or something. Is that what
yes.
he said? Yeah. So
yeah, exactly what he said.
So when he said that to me, that I was like, oh wow, they're going to do an Eat 'Em and Smile band reunion. And yeah, it never happened. It's just, seems the lack of anything, even interviews from him, it just seems strange. I mean, like you said, he does these internet shows where he controls everything, and you know,
right.
And definitely interesting, but and out there, in my opinion. But it's like there's no, I don't know. Just why wouldn't he do an interview? Like no interview with Rolling Stone, no talking with anyone. You know, it's just seems strange.
It's definitely a different David Lee Roth. I'll also say that. For this article I did for Guitar World a few months back, I got to interview Billy, Steve, and Greg Bissonette. All three of them made clear in so many words that if the schedule was clear and Roth called, they would all be willing to do it. So,
right.
You know, none of them were saying, oh, it's going to happen, or don't worry, I'm, you know, there. It's all of them were adamant to say it's Dave's call. You know, I can't say what's going to happen. I'm just saying if I got a phone call, I would do everything in my power to make it happen. So that was my read from those guys, that they are willing and interested and would like to do it, especially Vi was particular, and Sheehan particularly, were both saying how much they'd like to do it. So, you know, I think the ball's in Dave's court. If Dave wants to do it, I think those guys would, you know, they're all busy, especially Vi and Sheehan and those guys, and Bissonette's a studio drummer, does sessions all the time. They're busy, but I think they would do it. So it's on Dave, right? To decide if he wants to pull the trigger. And maybe, you know, maybe things are already in motion. I know Winery Dogs are doing stuff, and I know Vi is celebrating the anniversary of his great solo record in Passion and Warfare. I think it's the 25th anniversary. So, you know,
I wonder what the draw would be for that. I mean, I don't think they're going to be doing arenas, but definitely selling out big theaters, I think.
I think that's okay. I mean, I think that would be, goes back to the old show business adage, right? Sell out the place you can sell out. Don't try to oversell it. And I think, to me, it would be a great spectacle. And there's, you know, age has caught up to everybody, but I would really, really be excited to see those three guys. Bissonette is such a great drummer. The musicianship is off the hook. And the other thing that is worth mentioning too is that Sheehan said to me, yeah, I would do a song or two. I mean, none of those guys were saying no to any, from what I gathered, anything. You know, if they said, maybe not a record, but hey, let's do two songs. You know, let's do an old two songs or something, or one song for the tour. They'd do it. So I think that would be an exciting thing. Of course, as you observe, you know, we all thought this was going to happen 6-8 months ago, that we would get an announcement about this. And, you know, again, I go back to the thing I suspect, I don't know, that Dave is probably, again, waiting for the other shoe to drop before he makes his move.
Right, right. Interesting. And, you know, I remember we had Billy Sheehan on Talking Metal back a while ago, and he mentioned, I think, during that interview that Dave had one night over many glass bottles of wine said that he wanted to put back together the Eat 'Em and Smile Band. And this is years ago. This is like, you know, I don't know, before he rejoined Van Halen.
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
I think it was shortly before that, from what I remember. So interesting stuff. Anyways, Greg Renoff, the author of Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. It's available on Amazon. And what's your site, Greg?
VanHalenRising.com. And then I also just say, people, check me out on Twitter. Let's connect at Greg Renoff. And always appreciate the time. Love talking Van Halen with you, Mark. And thank you for just a great support over the months. It's been great.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for giving us some great Van Halen discussion here on Talking Metal. Greg, you take care, and we're going to wrap up today's show with a song off the Eat 'Em and Smile record. This is Big Trouble. Love this song. Love how just the aggression in Steve Vai's playing on this record. He always delivers some melodic and technically great stuff, but sometimes I feel like the aggression that he has on this Eat 'Em and Smile record isn't always there on all his other records, and I think that's one of the things that makes this record just such a great rock record. David Lee Roth's Eat 'Em and Smile record. Again, this is Big Trouble. Greg Renoff has been our guest today. Thanks for listening, guys. Take care.
around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.